Okay, Stephen, we want to welcome you to the Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade and Development for a talk on free learning and from a development perspective. So, Stephen, as you may know, is from the National Research Council of Canada, and he has daily newsletters, The Old Daily, and he is one of the originators of the massive open online course, MOOCs. And he's obviously a popular speaker, and we have this great opportunity to learn from Stephen and to interact with him. So without further ado, Stephen, please go ahead.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm just going to check my levels on the recording. They seem to be good. So hello, people on the recording. I always like to say hello to the people on the recording. So I'm going to spend maybe half an hour talking on this topic. We're not a large group, so do feel free, please, to interrupt me. Je peux parler en français aussi. Si vous avez des questions, je suis heureux à répondre en français ou en anglais. Mais mon français n'est pas fort, mais je pense que ce sera assez. So let me give you a bit of background about myself very briefly to begin. My expertise, and I tried to make this clear before I came here, isn't on international development particularly. I do have expertise in a few core areas, including educational theory, specifically ways that we learn, also educational technology. I've built educational technology and I understand it very well, and as well policy and process to support the development of free and open access to learning. And these are the things that I've focused on over the years. I've worked with the National Research Council since 2001, previously taught philosophy, believe it or not, at the University of Alberta, Grand Prairie Regional College, and elsewhere. I've done instructional technology development for Assiniboine Community College, University of Alberta, and I'm currently the program leader for what's called the Learning and Performance Support System at National Research Council. It's one of our new programs. It's a $19 million initiative to develop personal learning and support systems. For who? Good question. For whoever needs it, honestly. The primary focus is workplace training, development, and support. But the idea of LPSS is that the learning and development is focused on the individual rather than the institution in order to provide multiple routes to access learning from formal providers, from businesses, from private providers, whoever provides learning, and to mix and match these offerings together. So I'll talk a little bit more about that during the talk. I've got some, not extensive, but some developments background. I worked for a while in Calgary with the Arusha Center. They were really good people. Now the center doesn't exist anymore, which is too bad. Also the Development Education Coordinating Council of Alberta. I've done work with First Nations communities. I've gone up to Northern Alberta, taught on the reserves. I've also done work with First Nations communities in Manitoba. And I've worked with some international projects. I was talking with Denise earlier about the work I did in Colombia with Diego Liao and others with the EduCamp program, part of their education revolution, which they've been working on since 2006. I've been back there a number of times supporting this. I've also worked with Lucifer Chu on an open object system. Basically what they're doing is taking open courseware, which I'll talk a bit about, and using community source to translate it into Chinese. He's based in Taipei. Lucifer Chu is most well known for being the person who translated Lord of the Rings into Chinese. Nobody thought there would be a market. interestingly. I've also done work with the Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie. We recently completed a massive open online course with them. on open learning resources, and also we're working with the Arab League Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, again, to develop and open learning resources and to build capacity. The talk's about free learning, and free learning, it's intuitively an accessible idea, but it's important to drill down a bit into what that really means. I see it as meaning three major things. First of all, free as in gratis, that is to say without the requirement of payment of money, but also without the requirement of other forms of payment. There are different ways institutions and companies can demand compensation, for example, your information, background, advertising, marketing, etc. Free learning also means free as in libre. What that means is the right and the ability to be able not simply to access the learning resources, but to share them and distribute them, remix them as you wish, to use them in your own context for your own purposes. And then open as in door. What I mean by this is access to learning itself, access to learning resources and institutions of learning without restraint or condition based on your background, social, economic standing, etc. In other words, without prior condition. All of these form aspects of free learning. So what I'm going to talk about today really is from three perspectives. First of all, we'll talk about what can be done, what free learning means from the perspective of pedagogy. Then I'll talk a bit about what has been done, where we are now, and then I'll talk about what should be done, what free learning looks like from the development and policy framework. That's the plan. I'll go a bit briskly, because I have lots of slides. I'd be going briskly, even if I had zero slides. But if I am zipping through things too fast, tell me to slow down, please. Or if I'm too slow and boring, you tell me to speed up. And if it's really bad, tell me to leave. I'm just kidding. Do feel free to interrupt me. It's not about me. It's about you getting the information that you need. And it's about the people on the audio. Not want to forget you. I'm just kidding. So, okay, what can be done? In education, here's what's already happened in education is that there has been a shift in the nature of pedagogy. It's a really important shift. Not everybody is clear about that shift. And what it is a shift from instruction based on behaviorist ideas of learning by rote, learning content by memorization. And it's a shift toward what are called constructivist pedagogies. And what that means essentially is pedagogies that are based on authentic or engagement with authentic problems. There's also a shift in the way learning is understood in these two perspectives. On the one hand, in the older instructivist model, learning is thought of as obtaining, if you will, content, knowledge, sets of facts, principles, things like that. And again, the idea is you might think of learning as piling up or building knowledge on top of itself. Paulo Freire called that the banking theory of learning. The newer constructivist model is based on a theory of learning based on understanding and conceptual formation. The idea of constructivism is that people construct internal representations of a knowledge domain in their mind rather than trying to build sets of facts or information. Although there is some dispute in the field, I take this basically as a fait accompli. This transition has been made. It characterizes education in Canada. It characterizes education in virtually all of the nations that test well in international standards, such as OECD's PISA examinations. So that's where we are. Connectivism is an approach developed by George Siemens and myself, among many other people. Can also be thought of under the heading of learning networks. And it's the idea that knowledge is created by networks of connected entities, or more specifically, knowledge is a set of connections among entities. And it's kind of a hard concept, but if you we have the TV screen there. The image on that screen is not formed by the content of the individual pixels. Those contents are just, you know, red, orange, blue. If you added it up, you'd have like 250 red, 800 blue. That's not what's on the screen, obviously. What's on the screen is there. It can be interpreted by us because of the organization and the arrangement of the pixels. That's what's meant by connectivist knowledge. In the mind, we work the same way. We can think of neurons as sets of pixels. There's obviously not an exact match here. But if you think of our knowledge is like a picture that goes across these sets of pixels. Now, it's not literally a picture. We don't want to say, you know, we have pictures in the mind, although we can imagine them, but that's not really what's meant. But what it is that the knowledge that we have is created by these connections among the neurons in our mind. This is general. This can be generalized. The knowledge that is held by a society, for example, isn't the content of documents and things like that. It's the set of connections in and among the people in that society. I'll give you an example. Flying the 747 from Paris to New York. If you think about that, no one person has that knowledge. No one person could have that knowledge. The knowledge of flying a 747 from Paris to New York, it should be used a Canadian city, right, is actually distributed across a set of connected people. And what makes that knowledge possible is the connections and the interactions among those people. There's no one place you would find that knowledge. Now, you'll find tire making, windshield making, navigation, serving coffee in a bumpy air, reservations, all of that distributed across a wide set of people. It's kind of an odd concept, but the alternative concept that it's replacing is the idea that knowledge is like brain writing. Or actual text in our minds, or actual pictures in our minds. This is a bit different, right? This is knowledge at what we might call a sub-symbolic level. Knowledge as this distribution of information rather than sets of paragraphs, sets of facts, etc. So, without lingering on this too much, because I don't think about our whole time, learning on this model is the development of these networks. Can be a focus both on personal neural network development, or it can be a focus on social network development. It can be developing personal knowledge or social knowledge, or any other network that we can think of. We can develop knowledge and learning in that network. And I'll talk about some other networks as we go along. And on this model, to learn is a matter of practice and reflection. And that actually makes sense, right? We don't learn just by receiving information from wherever. We learn really by practicing and using something. And what's actually happening here is as we practice, as we work with something, we're developing our brain as though it were a muscle. And that's the way we form these connections between neurons. How do we know that we've learned? To know, in this theory, is to recognize. And I sometimes say, you know, it's like when you see your spouse coming through a train station or at the airport, right? You pick them out of the crowd. How do you do that? You don't use rules or representations or anything like that. You look at them and you go, I recognize that person. It's a quick, like, sometimes I talk about it as snap to awareness. And what that is the specific set of connections becomes activated when they're presented with a certain visual phenomenon. Similarly, social learning is the same sort of thing. Society can become instantly aware of some sort of phenomenon. It's not like one person tells another, tells another, tells another, but it's like everybody in society, each playing their own role, creates a social awareness of something. I'm sure you've seen that happen where, you know, at one moment a society is behaving one way, and then all of a sudden it seems they're doing something different. So I've been at this for a while.
Well, like people smoking, and then all of a sudden it's frowned upon and fewer people are smoking?
That's a good example, that sort of thing, yeah. Who was it? Gladwell wrote The Tipping Point, right? Mm-hmm. And he's trying to capture this kind of thing where, you know, it's like, all of a sudden, we change our perspective. It's just a little small change is what pushes us over, because it's not an accumulation thing; it's a pattern thing, and we're moving from one pattern and make a small shift, and all of a sudden, it's a new pattern. So, like I said, I've been working on this for a very long time. My original basis in this work was in computer science and philosophy. And in a work called Connectionism, and that's where a lot of the models are derived from. But over time, what I've been able to see working with other people is that this is a phenomenon that's repeated not just in computers, not just in neural networks, but much more widely. So what connectivism entails is a theory of learning based in what makes networks successful. A network is successful if it's able to respond to phenomena, if it's able to change its shape, to be dynamic, to add connections, to drop connections. The term for it in the literature is plasticity. You might have heard of that, the plasticity of mind. And that's the idea that the mind itself, the brain itself, actually changes as a result of experience. So the principles of a network that make that change possible, I suggest, are the following four: autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity. This isn't the definitive list. You'll see these in many different places, of course. You see people like Richard Florida talking about the importance of diversity in society, for example. You see James Surowiecki talking about autonomy as important in what he calls the wisdom of crowds. These are phenomena that I've identified as being particularly important and playing particular roles in network formation. But I also think of them as planning criteria or evaluative criteria. If you're looking at some technology or looking at some program and asking yourself, does this support network-based approach, the question you ask is, does it support the autonomy of the individual members? Does it embrace diversity, etc.? And that allows you to make a decision. I use it to as a framework to advise people when I'm talking about technology adoption. If we're talking about learning technology, for example, you're looking at a new piece of software. Does it support these four things? Oops. So, free learning and connectivism go hand in hand. The one depends on the other. They reinforce and depend on each other. Free learning requires connectivism. Connectivism requires free learning. For example, autonomy as a pedagogical principle. If you believe autonomy is important, then the mechanisms to support autonomy are the mechanisms that support free learning. You need to support access to learning materials and resources without cost or barriers. You need to support connections or the possibility of connections with other learners, with instructors, with people in the workplace, with other people in the community. And you need to support open learning in the sense that people can enter and exit, equally important, a learning environment freely and without restraint. So what does that mean practically? The learning process in this sort of model is a model where to teach is to model and demonstrate, and to learn is to practice and reflect. And you might think that's a ridiculously simple, common, everyday pedagogy, and I agree. It is reflected in, I think, what is common knowledge about the process of learning and the process of teaching. What that means from a network learning and connectivist perspective is a rough learning process composed of four major parts. Aggregation, where you seek out resources, seek out information. This is the basis of instructivism, where you're expected to attend lectures. But it's also the basis of curiosity-driven learning. It's the basis of exploration and discovery. The idea here is the gathering input of whatever sort. The next stage is remix. And the idea here is the joining together, the bringing together of resources from different sources. Repurpose is to take this newly joined information or material or resource, shape it to your own local needs. And then feed forward is to send the newly created resource out into the network. What's interesting about this, to my mind, is that this isn't just a process that describes learning. This is a production process generally, right? It could be used to characterize the creation of typewriters, the growing of crops, anything. But it's also a model for learning. It's a generative, organic model for learning. And the idea of drawing out these four parts isn't to say follow these rules, but rather to identify important parts of the learning process. So far, so good? All right, we're about 10% of the way done. Okay, so what has been done? This is the part where I say, I'm not making all this stuff up. I'm sometimes accused of that, and I'm a little bit sensitive. Well, I'm not really, but even if I was making this up, I'd still think it was right. But no, there is a really solid foundation in a bunch of other sciences for this. There is a foundation for network theory in mathematics. It's known as graph theory. It was pioneered by people like Leonard Euler, and it's been carried on by people like Alfred Laszlo Barabasi and others. In computer science, and again, this is where I came into the field, there's an approach called connectionism. Today they'll talk about neural network systems in computer science. They'll talk about learning theories in computer science, and more recently stuff called deep learning. I was introduced by people like Rosenblatt back in the 70s. The major influence is Rummelhart and McClellan in the 1980s came out with a massive two-volume set called Parallel Distributed Processing. In biology, there's the whole area of ecology and ecosystems, although I want to pause and distinguish between network theory and systems theory. Systems theory is goal-oriented and teleological. Network theory is not. There are no goals built into a network. So there is a difference here between the idea of an ecosystem is directed towards some end, whatever it is, and a network is simply being a set of connections. I think it's an important distinction.
Can I interrupt by asking a question around results? We're very much focused on results and results-based management.
Right.
But when you talk about there being no, we're all about goals. We're all about expected results within a certain period of time. Does that jive with the theory, the network theory?
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm pausing to think about that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
My first reaction is the focus on results can incline you to be more likely to develop systems rather than networks.
Mm.
The difficulty from my perspective is the building of a system devoted toward a particular outcome means that you've created something that's not dynamic and resilient, right? So, and that's the difference between a network and and a system. So my, what I would do, even in, and this is what I do do, even in a results-oriented environment, is that I develop the network and then evaluate the network for outcomes rather than design the network in order to support the outcomes. So it's, and I know it's not necessarily fashionable, but I'm process-driven because the process will produce results, as opposed to results-driven in the sense that the results define the process. Does that help?
Yeah, no, that definitely helps.
Yeah, okay, so sociology, there's a range of thinkers who looked at not just systems, but also networks. There's Harrison White, I think. I'm trying to remember if I got but more recently and more importantly, Duncan J. Watts, who wrote, it's based on the 6 degrees of connection. I forgot the name of his book. It's terrible. But basically, it's social network analysis, the idea that any person in a society is 6 hops away from being connected with any other person in society. So I know you, you know so-and-so, he knows so-and-so, she knows so-and-so, he knows President Obama. Right. So it's 6 degrees of separation. It's sometimes known as the Kevin Bacon theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've heard
of it.
Yeah. So, it's silly, but I can't remember the name of his book. Alfred Laszlo Barabasi is another person who's been involved in this, and a number of others. Physiology, science of perception. David Mars, a good example here of some of the early work, the idea of layers of neural networks processing perceptions, producing what has been identified as what they call the 2.5 dimensional representation, and then these flowing through layers of networks into deeper and deeper layers of the brain. People like Patricia Smith Churchland, who wrote a book called Neurophilosophy. Again, the idea that knowledge and learning is based on connection with neural networks as opposed to the creation of concepts, representations, or other cognitive structures. It's really hard to wrap your head around sometimes. And in philosophy, there's the whole range of information theory, but also the philosophy of representation and distributed representation. On the other side are people like Chomsky, Fodor, and Polishin, but people writing on the side of distributed representation include people like Stephen Stitch, Stephen Kosslyn, and others. So it's a real thing. It exists. And I wish I could remember the name of Duncan J. Watts. It's just called 6 degrees or something. My memory is very good, but as I get older, it gets patchy.
Oh, yeah.
Does that sound familiar to anyone?
No. On the neuroscience front, this becomes more and more an area of interest for education specialists within DFAT-D, particularly the early childhood level, the 0 to 4 in particular. And it's something that where we have a keen interest.
As you should. And talking about it this way, when you simply talk about learning as, say, concept formation, you forget about the really important physical basis of learning. But when we understand that learning is actually the development of neural structures in the brain, we see the foundational importance of things like early experience, because, like, and Barabasi talks about this, right? There's, you know, the first sets of connections are the ones that are really important. You have what's called preferential attachment, and the network builds on itself. And once that's in, you know, it's not impossible, but it gets more and more difficult to change what what happened in your early years, but also, too, the physiological basis, environment, nutrition, things like that. There's a clear connection between these and learning that are so critical. And then finally, the totality of experience. People talked about the socioeconomic barrier to learning, and they're quite right to point that out. Socioeconomic standing is the number one predictor of learning outcomes. It's been established in study after study after study. But it's not simply because they don't have resources, not simply because they don't have adequate nutrition, although they play a role. But also, the learning takes place every minute you're awake, which means that parental involvement, community involvement, all of these are as equally important as schools. So you get things like the development of expectations, development of goals, values. All of these inform learning. And people who are in a certain social economic group get different background, different values, different expectations, and these all have an impact on learning as well. That's why you sometimes see almost boot camp-like programs that show some success in turning people from disadvantaged groups around. Now, the process is awful because it's boot camp, right? You completely removed their autonomy. But they achieve success because they're addressing points of learning that would not typically be addressed in school. Like everything from your attitudes about attendance, presence, and motivation, to even the way you speak and the way you react to people. Personally, I think these results are short-term, right? You can go in and do a boot camp. It's a six-week process, and you measure that'll be an impact. But for a lifetime impact, you really need a lifetime development. So there's so many factors that come into play. And you don't really get at this with a network theory unless you have a network theory of learning. If you think of learning as just static structures, cognition, and that, then you don't see the impact of the other aspects of society. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important.
Just a reminder, Stephen, we've got about 15 minutes to go, and I know that there's questions from the participants here.
And I'd be happy to stop here and do questions. I don't have this completion.
Okay. Very, very good. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Zara?
No, I'd like to hear the rest if possible, if there's only
absolutely. You've got 15 minutes, but I just wanted to make sure that people had an opportunity to ask questions.
This is what the third part,
All right, let's zip through some stuff here. All right, so, okay, again, still in what's already happening. We see the network principles that I've been talking about out there now in society. Everything from the internet, the organization of open source software, which is distributed and not managed centrally. Eric Raymond's Cathedral and the Bazaar is a good example. To forms of organization, I misspelled that, but that should be the clue train with, manifesto. To open access and things like the Open Archive Initiative. Open educational resources, which I've mentioned, is a subset of this. It was defined as a concept by UNESCO in 2002. May be defined according to educational standards like learning object metadata or content packaging, but doesn't have to be. It could be any resource that acts as an educational resource. It could be an open educational resource. And the status of these varies considerably depending on the licensing. You may be familiar with these kinds of licensing. Really, there's three models. If you had to break it down, there's the GPL or viral licensing, where the resource is completely open and free, the way I defined it earlier. And when you share the license or feed it forward, the license travels with it, like a virus, right? So that the resource or anything developed using the resource remains free and openly accessible. That was, of course, originally developed by Richard Stallman. Creative Commons is kind of like almost like that, but not really. Right? It's like free licensing, but the creators of resources are allowed to preserve some rights, some limitations. And specifically, they can require attribution so they get credit for their work. They can require that the work only be used non-commercially. That's how I license all of my materials, is non-commercial. Because if it's going to be used commercially, I want a contract. They can require that the resource be shared but not altered or changed. Cartoonists are really big on this. You don't want to change Calvin and Hobbes, really. No one would want to. And Bill Watterson wouldn't want you to. And then share alike, which is the viral thing again, right? If you have share alike on a Creative Commons license, that means that if you create something with this material, the license has to travel with it. So the Creative Commons will allow free sharing of resources with some restrictions. And then finally, there's what might be called open access rights reserved. This is like 90% of the content on the internet, where you can freely access it, like a YouTube video or something like that, but you don't own it, you don't have the right to share it or to make derivatives or anything like that. They're letting you look at it, but you can't have it. It's also, if you buy music or books or anything like that, that's the right you get there. Right? You can listen to the music, but you can't share it with your friends legally. So it's sort of like open, but it's sort of like not open. Mm-hmm. So in traditional courses, we've seen the use of open educational resources. There's a bunch of initiatives. Rice University built something called Connections. That should be with an X, spelled correct. Change that on Connexions. Wiki Educator, or Open Education Resources University. That's something developed by the Commonwealth of Learning. MIT OpenCourseWare, Open Universities, Open Learn. All of these, what they are is the development of learning resources using an open license, almost always Creative Commons, to create traditional courses or traditional course packages. Now, what I mean by that is a course designed pretty much on the instructionist model. It's a set of content that you're expected to consume in some way, to watch or read, and then to learn, to master. Very traditional education, the way we're familiar with it. This is from Open Educational Resources University. What this gets at is the idea that there are multiple kinds of content. It's not just the learning resource itself, but it's also the test instrument that is used that can be shared. It's also the actual instruction that can be shared, the person giving a lecture. It's the actual, even the credentialing, and degrees or recognition diploma. In the open OER university model, everything is open except the credentialing. The credentialing is handled by traditional institutions. My criticism of that model is that, first of all, it's too curricular, too traditionally based, too much like instructivism. It's educating people just in case they might need it, rather than educating what they need when they need it. But also, it's a tight link to traditional credentials. I know these are important to many people around the world, but at the same time, it creates this barrier to access, right? You can access all the open learning material in the world you want, but if you have to pay them tuition to get the credential, you've really created a barrier. George Siemens and I developed an alternative called the Connectivist MOOC, or CMOOC. We did this in 2008, and basically what we did is we created a course in the form of a network. This isn't new, really. Etienne Wenger had a theory called communities of practice, which is done in very much the same sort of way. On the internet itself, we've seen multiple instances of networks of people getting together to do something, usually, or to learn something or follow something, everything from, you know, I signed up for a George Orwell list, and basically it's just, they ran his diaries over a period of years. I followed this for years because they did it on a day-by-day basis. It took a long time. You name it. Aaron Brewer once wrote an article about people who study beekeeping, and they form communities online, and they're interested in beekeeping. This was before all this old, you know, colony collapse disease, and it's just people were interested in bees. So the idea, what we did is we set this up. We asked participants to participate, not by coming to our course, but to stay on their own internet presence, their own blogs, their own homepage, their own community or group, their own Facebook account, whatever they liked to use. And then what we did is we created an environment where we connected them. So the idea is that we looked at a topic. We've done a number of these over the years. We seed it with some open educational resources. Sometimes we'd create some stuff. More often, we'd find stuff that already existed because we had no budget. And so this was a way of getting the material in. We'd seed the discussion, and then we'd go through the material over a course of a few weeks, and people could participate however they wanted. This, again, it's about autonomy and diversity, right? We don't want to march everybody through the same curriculum. Rather, it's like, it's there, and then the community forms around it and makes its own decisions about how it's going to work. And there's no individual makes a decision. The way the course goes is whatever the people as a whole decide to do. And it's really interesting because the knowledge produced in these courses did not exist at the start of the course. And the knowledge in the course is produced through the process of people contributing to the course. So it creates something new. And not just a repetition of existing knowledge. I mentioned the EduCamp that we did in Colombia. The EduCamp was basically this model, but in a physical room, or a series of physical rooms, because we did it a number of times. And again, we came in, we made resources available to people. There were different stations, we had technology, computers, video software, network software, graphics, whatever, right? And actually, we encouraged people to bring their own software, their own ideas, and we just made the stations available. And then the participants can go to whatever station they want. They can come when they want. They can leave when they want. And they have hands-on interaction with the tool and with the person who has brought the tool. And then whatever happens is the outcome. Right? So we don't have a predetermined outcome, but the evaluation for this, and I'm thinking of the question that you asked earlier, is this transformative? Did this change what they could do? And the evidence seems to be, yes, it is. And we see that they go back to their communities with this new knowledge, but also with the idea of sharing the knowledge and creating their own network. And this has been done iteratively in Colombia over a number of years since I first went down there in 2006, but the first EduCamp, I think, was 2008, and it's been developed iteratively since then.
Is there a facilitator or to help them start and move on?
Well, in Colombia, it was a couple of things. One of the roles that I had was at the beginning of the session, I'd talk about the model. So it actually, it's sort of ironic. It begins very traditionally, right? I talked about, here's what we're doing. Here's how we structured this. Here's why we're doing it this way. And then Diego, who's the main facilitator there, who speaks Spanish, I don't speak Spanish, was made life interesting. So he typically organized groups of volunteers, usually from the local technical institution or university. He was with the Ministry of Education. They set up a computer network in the room, and the ministry paid for that so that there were computers and access. And then the volunteers would come in, set up their individual stations, and There was no predefined list of we have to have this, we have to have this. It was whatever they thought was important, that's what they would bring. And really, it was the only management care was to try to avoid overlap. Right? We didn't want, you know, 10 stations, all of them doing video production. That wouldn't make much sense. So someone would bring video production. Someone would bring audio, like Audacity that's on my computer. Some of them would bring graphics. Some of them bring blogging. Someone else would bring wiki technology. It was different every time, right? And so that's how it was facilitated. And it looked like that. That's the model of our course online, but that's also what, you know, if you represented it conceptually, almost what an EduCamp looks like, where there is no center, there is no guiding principle, but there's a bunch of interacting parts where, you know, you might have stations, you have people going between the stations, and each individual's experience of this thing is unique. Any person in our course could go from here to here to here to here to here to here or wherever, or they can bring in their own resources. This was the starting point. This is what we set up. And then the course, and this has been the case for all the courses we've offered, built on that and became much more complex and much more interesting. So, since then, there's been a thing called the XMOOC. And this is what the big universities did with our concept. They took it, they kept the open access part of it, although, you know, the very limited open access, not the viral kind of license, but the, you know, you can see it, but you can't use it kind of open access. And they adapted it to the traditional learning model. A lot of the stuff you may have read in magazines or newspapers and the media generally about MOOCs is really about ex-MOOCs. It's about things like Coursera, Udacity, edX, taking these resources and putting them in traditional course structures. And that hasn't worked. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's kind of worked. But Sebastian Thrun, who founded Udacity, said, and I quote, "We have terrible software." Open resources need connectivism as much as connectivism needs open resources. You can't have open learning, really, in a traditional learning format, because it means that your participants aren't autonomous anymore. Means that the materials that they're looking at aren't diverse anymore. So you become closed and structured, and that limits the impact of the learning. It certainly limits the personal nature of the impact of the learning.
Okay. Now, we've run out of time. Does anybody have any questions for Stephen?
The third part was going to be what you should do.
Right. What should be done? Skip. All right. Roles for government. First of all, building this communications and education infrastructure. We need the technology backbone. That's the first thing that they did in Colombia was to build the infrastructure. You can't do this without the infrastructure. So, and people, every time I talk about online learning, people talk about electrification, for example. Totally get that. So that's really key and important. But again, the architecture, the infrastructure should be distributed. It should be a network kind of infrastructure as much as possible. I could go on about that. Secondly, support for open educational resources. There are different production of sustainability models. But the main thing is the development, production, and distribution of open education resources needs to be supported. A lot of times it's a policy decision, not a financial decision. A government, for example, produces tons of resources, but they are, in Canada at least, automatically assigned Crown copyright, do not recopy, do not distribute, etc. That's contrasted with the U.S. government, where material produced by the government is public domain. As a result, the U.S. has had a significant advantage in the development of open learning and open educational resources. Support for free learning. There's a range of supports needed in order to enable people to obtain learning and obtain credentials outside the traditional system. The more restrictive access to learning is, and especially access to credentials are, the harder it is for people to be able to take advantage of it. And that's why the last one is the management of assessment and credentialing. We're moving into an environment, and this is happening now, where we're about to get a proliferation of credentials. It used to be credentials were university degrees, maybe CGA, something like that. But now there's a whole range. The magazine Condé Nast is producing credentials.
Oh, wow.
I'm trying to remember. There's a whole list of them that I did in a talk the other day. Microsoft is issuing credentials. Google is issuing credentials. So we kind of want to be on top of that. But we also want to be able to support that and be able to recognize that. It's a double-edged sword, right? Lots of credentials mean that the credentials become a bit flaky, but lots of credentials create lots of opportunities for people to learn through alternative mechanisms. And so there's going to need to be a policy effort directed toward that. So in overview, those are the major things. There's the infrastructure.
Okay. Well,
are you in touch with IDRC? Depends on what you mean by in touch with.
I've communicated with them. They have this whole initiative on open education resources, and they have a whole division in charge of this area. And so I'm not sure if you connect with them.
I'm not really connected with them. There's a bit of territoriality, I guess. I don't know if that's the best word to use, but especially from a policy perspective, and at NRC we don't do policy. So also at NRC we don't really have money to fund or sustain things like that in IDRC. But I do know of IDRC, I do know of the work that they're doing, but we're not directly tied. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
At what level is it working better? With school children, with youth, at the university level, vocational training, in what domain?
That's such a hard question because there's no simple answer. A lot of effort has been focused, and I think for good reason, on teachers and educators. Mm-hmm. One of the common things that I hear is that there's a real capacity need for educators. Everywhere I go, I'm hearing that. I have two responses. On the one hand, we need to reduce the dependence on educators. I agree. But on the other hand, we have to put in place support so that educators can build their own capacity. And that's the focus. Mm-hmm. It's a big part of the focus of the EduCamps was on educators. The work with Alexo, again, is with educators. So that's one thing. The second thing, and this is just me speaking, right, and not necessarily research on this point, but it seems to me that there is, in pretty much every community I've visited, a set a segment of society, youth in particular, who are very connected and very attuned, and they seem like a natural demographic to me. And I see them, and you can see them. I'm walking down the street, and you'll see sometimes just an open door. And you look in this open door, because I do that. that's what it is. And you'll see, like, you know, dozens of computers and, you know, a bunch of, you know, I would call them kids now, but they're not, right? You know, they're like 15 to 18 to 20. They're in that age. And they've got all of this gear, these computers, and they're using them, right? I don't know what they're doing. They can be writing viruses or whatever, right? Man. But the thing is, they're connected and they're competent in the technology, and they seem like a natural vector to me for learning and development. And it really seems like a demographic that we want to reach. So that would be a second one, just because they exist. And I see them everywhere. The malls. Not malls like we have malls, but those malls with the little tiny stalls in them. There's a six-story mall in Kuala Lumpur that's nothing but technology. And it's filled with people between the ages of like 15 to 20. And they each have their own little stall. And then there's all the people who are there in that community. It's this incredible tech community that exists. Mm-hmm. I guess the third group would be the very young. And this is what Nicholas Negroponte was trying to reach with the One Laptop Per Child initiative, which I think actually did have an impact. It's really hard to measure. It didn't have the a whole bunch of people got school diplomas kind of impact, but you see them. You see kids with these computers sitting on steps or whatever, using them. Who knows what for, but they're using them. They were terrible computers. They really were. I loved the concept, but I hated the computer. But getting computers into the hands of the really young, the primary school, It just gives them so much capacity. People talk about, well, you need this, you need that, you do, right? You need power. Sometimes you need bandwidth, but even a computer without bandwidth is a lot. The neat thing about the Negroponte project is that the computers could create a local area network because they were networked with each other, and that produced some interesting. So even if you don't have internet access, you can still have a bunch of people with these computers who are able to talk to each other just through wireless communication. So that's pretty useful. But people compare, a book and a computer. They say, well, a book, anybody can use a book and all of that. But a computer isn't a book. A computer is 1,000 books, 10,000 books. And books that can do things. And to put that sort of thing, it's this overall environment thing, right? It's not simply that you've given somebody some learning and a learning tool. You've made them realize that there is this capacity in the world where you can interact with devices, you can make devices do things, you can build things and do more than be passive. And so it builds that. Mm-hmm. It builds a sense of self-determinism, and it builds a sense of autonomy. And I think that's what Negroponte really wanted to do with these computers. There's an awful lot of social conditions that speak against that. I think he ran into that as well. But I think that's a worthwhile thing to be trying to do.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. This has been very, very interesting, and we very much appreciate you coming to speak to us today. And we hope that we'll have a connection with you into the future. We know about all of the opportunities to do so through your website, and we're going to put this on our own or have a connection to a link to wherever you're going to place this audio.
Okay, yeah, I'll send you the link, but I'll basically have a presentation site on my website. It'll be 344, I think. it'll have a number, but I'll send you that.
Very
and
good.
It'll have the slides on it, and it'll have the audio. So I didn't do all the slides. I don't feel badly, but they're there, and they're still useful, and you may find them useful.
Yeah, we will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you.
That's great.
Sorry.
No. Everybody was very keen on you continuing for sure, and we all learned a lot. I'm sorry the person from Jamaica couldn't be here, but you know, it's great that they'll have an opportunity.